We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls. When he was a candidate running for president, Barack Obama was rather critical of the education reform law known as No Child Left Behind. Now that he is president, his administration has proposed some rather significant changes in this law, altering long-term goals for student performance, looking for ways beyond math and reading to measure achievement, and also trying to offer schools perhaps more in the way of rewards when students do well, and moving away from punishment when they fail to meet the standards. So those are just some of the things that are on the table right now. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will be talking about this whole subject of school accountability and some of the proposed changes to No Child Left Behind. And there are a number of other things that we'll talk about as well. And our guest for the show is Lizanne DiStefano. She's professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois. She's the Fox Family Professor of Education and is also involved with something called iSTEM, the iSTEM Education Initiative. We will be talking and we'd be happy to have questions, comments from people who are listening. This is a subject we've talked about before, and we're pleased that she could be with us once again to talk. Questions are welcome. Now, if you'd like to call, there are two numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome, once David. Again. Thanks for inviting me on this beautiful day.
I think here the administration, as I understand it, they basically have two main things that they're thinking about in terms of education policy mm-hmm. and things that might be done to improve public education. One, and it is multifaceted, is the rewrite of No Child Left Behind, mm-hmm. which they, in fact, I think would like to give a different name. Mm-hmm. They don't even mm-hmm. want to call it that anymore. Mm-hmm. There's another thing that I think we'll try to touch on, and that is something they call race to the top. Mm-hmm. And people I know have heard about that. This involves very significant amounts of money mm-hmm. that are part of the whole economic stimulus package that have been given to states. Two states got some of this money.
That's correct.
Illinois was a finalist but didn't.
That's correct.
And there yet is more money out there. And this is something that I know also is kind of controversial within the educational community. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. Starting with No Child Left Behind, maybe, again, it wouldn't hurt to say, all right, just in, 20 words or less, mm-hmm. what was the basic idea when this thing was written right. and signed into law back in 2002?
Right. Okay. Well, I think it's important to remember that the piece of legislation that we're actually talking about is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was actually first passed in 1963. And the purpose of that legislation is to define the federal role in education. And for decades, really, until No Child Left Behind was passed, the federal role in education was fairly limited. And education was really seen as the domain of states and localities. The federal government played a very superficial monitoring and funding role, but not a very heavy-handed role in mandating educational content and so on. In fact, up until No Child Left Behind, where ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act had been around for 40 years, it was probably best known for Title I funding, which is federal money that goes to schools with large numbers of students of poverty in those schools, and some information about facilities, the size of school buildings, you know, very, very kind of monitoring things, and not much about content at all. The Bush administration, if we remember, was fast out of the gate in passing No Child Left Behind, which was a massive overhaul of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and which greatly expanded the federal role in education. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act was up for reauthorization again in 2008. And the Bush administration did try very hard to push through a reauthorization at that time. But in the waning months of the Bush administration and with the illness of Senator Edward Kennedy, who was a major proponent of the bipartisan support of that bill, they were not able to get that reauthorization through. And so the reauthorization of ESEA actually now falls to the Obama administration. So that's sort of the big picture of the law that we're really talking about is Elementary and Secondary Act. And now the Obama administration has a chance to put its signature on that legislation.
Yeah. As you said, for such a long time, the federal government was not that involved in public education. And here in the United States, we have a very strongly held notion that local control of schools is very important. Mm-hmm. So we have local school boards. They're locally elected from their community. They make the important decisions about the schools. So I think one of the things that about No Child Left Behind, again, probably that's important as you look at this balance between federal and local control is what the federal government was saying to the states is we're demanding improvement in student performance.
Correct.
And we are going to say we want by a certain time, and the number they picked was 2014, all your students are going to function at a high level. Now, what that means, that's something else. But they said, okay, we're going to set this long-term benchmark. And then they said to the states, now, you set the standards. You decide what the standard is going to be.
Correct.
You decide what sort of testing or what sort of mechanism you're going to use to demonstrate the students meet the standards. That's all up to you.
Correct.
We're going to expect you to do that, but how you do it, that's up to you. And as an incentive or sanction, though, the government said to the states, federal funding is going to be tied to your hitting those targets.
Correct.
So that's the deal. We expect performance. You decide how you're going to do this. But if you don't make it, there will be sanctions. So the hope was, the idea was that ultimately this would lead to increased student performance. The students would do better, particularly as measured by standard tests of reading and math. Okay, so there was a long bit of exposition. Has during the time that No Child Left Behind has been in effect, can we say that math and reading has improved?
There have been, I think that the impact of No Child Left Behind is mixed, as you would expect in such a large and multifaceted reform effort. The kinds of positive changes that we've seen in No Child Left Behind is that there have been gains in the performance of American students in elementary reading, grade four reading, as measured by the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And we have seen reductions in achievement gaps between children of poverty and other students, between African American, Hispanic, and white students in reading. In math, at the elementary level. In math, we've also seen gains, modest gains in both fourth grade and eighth grade math, and small reductions in the achievement gaps there. So we have seen some evidence that an increased expectations for students and applying those expectations to all students within the school has resulted in modest gains in performance. Another area where we've seen gains is in students with disabilities who, for in many cases, did not participate in an academic curriculum. Their curriculum was more focused toward functional skills. We've seen with higher academic expectations, the performance of certain groups of students with disabilities has actually increased. So there, I think there's been a modest increase in student performance and at a national level under No Child Left Behind. Different states, of course, because there was so much variation in how states implemented it, had different results. But the National Assessment of Educational Progress would target those modest gains in certain areas. Mm-hmm. There's also been lots of reports of negative consequences of No Child Left Behind. Tremendous pressure on schools to produce levels of performance and growth in performance in students that far exceed any kind of gains that we've seen in this country in schools, you know, since the beginning of recorded data in that area. Tremendous pressure on teachers and principals, which has actually shown an increase in turnover of teachers and principals in schools and the decline of teaching as an attractive profession, largely because of the heavy sanction emphasis of No Child Left Behind. If you didn't meet the goals, there were lots of punishments and sanctions associated with it, much less in the rewards and incentives for performing. So I would say that the review of No Child Left Behind has been mixed. The idea of opening up the curriculum and exposing a broad range of students to a standard curriculum and high standards is generally viewed positively. The narrow focus on testing as the outcome measure is generally viewed negatively.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Lizanne DeStefano. She's professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois. She's the Fox Family Professor of Education. And she's here talking with us about No Child Left Behind, this major school reform legislation that was enacted in 2002 with the idea that it would improve student performance by setting standards and then forcing states to demonstrate students actually met those standards. And at a certain point, that meant that kids would all take tests to show where they were. The states got to set the standards. They developed the tests and then would face financial penalties from the federal government if they didn't meet their own standards. And now the Obama administration is looking at some retooling of No Child Left Behind, maybe even including giving it another name. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, clearly people are disappointed mm-hmm. that the performance of students wasn't better. Mm-hmm. Now I think one of the things that they've really abandoned is this long-term goal, this 2014 goal of having everybody to hit this high level.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the criticisms that has been made, and people try to get at this question of, well why didn't this have a more profound effect, was that the states got to set the standards
mm-hmm.
and that they fiddled around with things and that, in fact, that maybe that some states made sure that the kids cleared the bar by mm-hmm. setting that bar very low.
Mm-hmm.
And some people say that's the reason that students' performance hasn't improved.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there's some truth to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think one of the unfortunate characteristics of No Child Left Behind was that goal of all students meeting standards by 2013 or 2014, and then, you know, not being specific about what those standards were and what it meant to meet those standards, putting that in the hands of states and localities. I think the blueprint for the Obama administration, and just to make it clear, we're just beginning the process of reauthorization now. So we do not have a reauthorized ESEA. The first months of the Obama administration were really taken up with the economic crisis, the healthcare reform. And so now the attention is turning to reauthorization. So at this point, we're only getting ideas about what they're thinking about for reauthorization. But I think it's very interesting to look how they're phrasing that idea of the target that we're working towards. Instead of all students meeting standards by 2013, they are really linked at the idea of college completion and work readiness. And one of the things that the president talks about over and over again is that 20 years ago, we led the world in college completion, and now we're 11th in the world in terms of the percentage of our students who complete college. So the new goal of the ESEA reauthorization is really saying to have the U.S. regain its lead in college completion by 2020. And by 2020, every student should graduate from high school or be on track to graduate from high school, ready for college and career. So you see the shift in saying you're going to complete, you're going to cross this bar, you're going to meet these standards, and saying you're going to be ready for college and career.
And although I think, again, now we, even though we're talking about a kind of a different goal,
mm-hmm.
we seem to be bumping up against the same problem in the sense that people are saying, okay, it's all well and good to mm-hmm. use a phrase like college and career ready.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question is, how do you determine that?
Right. And the proposed mechanism here is once again a standards mechanism, but the standards are now called college and career ready standards. Mm-hmm. And they've actually been developed by a consortium of 48 states and two U.S. territories, the Council for Chief State School Officers, and the National Governors Association, who've developed common core standards in English, language, arts, and math, which all of these states and territories have agreed to adopt, and which in their development process are said to have been aligned with college and career expectations. So we're moving from a model where every state decided their own standards, and we're really not benchmarked. We're benchmarked in a number of different ways, to now a set of common core standards that business entities and higher education entities have said, yes, this makes sense for people to leave high school with these set of skills and be successful in college and career.
And are we still talking about some kind of standardized testing at regular points being the thing that we're going to use to determine whether or not the students meet the standard?
I think that the difference here, certainly standardized testing is a part of the accountability equation, but I believe what the current administration's plans are in this area is to really broaden the set of evidence that could be used for college and career state readiness beyond just a single state test, which was really what No Child Left Behind emphasized, to a collection of information. And a part of the Race to the Top money, $435 million of Race to the Top money, is being put to establishing new systems of accountability that include assessment but also include other types of student information, end-of-course assessments, teacher evaluations, other evidence that would allow people to judge whether a student was really leaving high school with the ability to be successful in adult life.
We have some callers. We want to bring them into the conversation.
Okay.
We'll start with someone here in Champaign County where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you know the details of this. I just heard about it, so... there are two sort of scandals coming out of Chicago schools. One of them is this fabrication of results.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be, and then the other is the A list. And we had the I list here. Apparently, friends of Arnie were also getting special attention in the choice program. And I just think that this turnaround school corporate ethic thing is just awful for the communities. There are people in Chicago that believe that the disruption of the schools in the neighborhoods that happened. There was a military school instituted. One of them was changed over. One was made a charter school in this area where this horrendous beating to death happened. And people up there allege that it's being done. These school rearrangements and turnarounds are really being done in a terribly ham-handed way without participation with a lot of the community. So there's it seems to me that when Bush came in, he was championing this one district in Texas, and it turned out that was all fabricated, or a lot of it was fabricated records too, where they weren't counting people that left, which is pretty bogus. So I think that this is an awful thing, and using the stimulus money to stipulating that you have to take any limits off of charter schools to receive it is really intimidation. I don't know what the right word for it is, but I'd like you to react to some of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, certainly you can see Secretary Arne Duncan, current Secretary of Education, is, of course, the former CEO of Chicago Public Schools, and certainly many of the initiatives that were used in Chicago. When you read the blueprint for reauthorization, you can see characteristics of those initiatives, and one of them is certainly the turnaround schools. A key part of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, and also of Race to the Top and the reauthorization, is targeting the lowest performing 5% of schools and doing very specific interventions at those schools. One is transformation, which is taking out the principal, rehiring, recurriculuming, redoing the school. The next one is the turnaround, which the Colin was talking about, which is replacing the principal and rehiring the staff of the school. Restarting is closing and reopening under a management organization, and closure is actually closing the school and taking the kids and putting them into other schools. Those four strategies are a piece of the reauthorization, and I agree with the caller. There's a lot of disagreement on this. Is this a good thing or is it a bad thing? And this is where I think the educational research community is going to be really called on to step up and produce evidence to say which of these things really have research and evaluation evidence to support them, and how can we use what we've learned from our other experiences to inform the reauthorization of this law. So this is a perfect example of that.
I don't know if I can give the call a very quick follow-up.
Okay,
if you
well,
want.
I just wanted to mention that there's a former member of the Bush administration who was came in to work with No Child Left Behind,
mm-hmm.
who has just written a mea culpa for
uh-huh.
it. And I can't. You probably know her name.
Diane Ravitch.
Yeah.
So I looking for her analysis is, I think, would inform the discussion. So thanks a lot.
Yes. Right.
Well, we hope to have her on the show, by the way. She has a new book out, and she's doing interviews, so I'm hoping that sometime in the future we can have her on the program. Real quick, before I go on to other callers,
mm-hmm.
just to carry on just for a moment to and give you a chance to talk a little bit about Race to the Top.
Mm-hmm.
This is economic stimulus money
right.
that's offered to schools. The schools, it was a competition. Schools put in proposals.
Mm-hmm.
Money has now gone to two, and we're talking about some big money here.
Mm-hmm.
Delaware got over $100 million. Tennessee got over $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
Illinois was a finalist but didn't get any money. There are still $3 billion remaining to be given out. And I think a lot of people say, you know, does this really make sense? Given that so many districts are struggling financially, does it make sense to just pick a few and give them these enormous amounts of money?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that really make sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the chronology of this has been kind of interesting, because Race to the Top and the Reinvestment Recovery Act obviously was the launch of the Obama administration. So it preceded the reauthorization. And so one of the criticisms is, why are you putting out all this money for reform and then reauthorizing the law? How are you going to align these very large investments that you're making with states with a law that has not been passed yet? And so when you read the blueprint for the reauthorization, you'll see that the four pieces of Race to the Top actually provide the framework for the reauthorization, and they are improving principal and teacher effectiveness, providing information for families and educators to improve education, implement college and career readiness standards and assessments and improving student learning and achievement in America's lowest performing schools. So the same four goals that are driving Race to the Top are also the four goals that are driving the reauthorization, and that's how they're trying to achieve alignment. I was just at a Race to the Top meeting yesterday, and Jim Shelton, who's leading a particular piece, the Innovation Fund part of Race to the Top, said that this investment, this federal investment in education, is unprecedented. There's never been this level of federal grants to schools for changes in education. And he said it's a big experiment, and it's either going to go down as a tremendous success or a huge failure. And part of that is going to be the sincerity with which states actually undertake these reforms that they're proposing. And the second part is going to be how much we evaluate it and can actually say that positive changes were linked to those. So your question, is this a good idea? I think in some cases, the economic instability is causing states to really be willing to rethink new ways of doing things that are more efficient and more effective. And so this infusion of federal money could actually help them to make these changes. On the other hand, if the federal money is really being viewed as replacing money that that they haven't been paid from the state or that they're lacking from other sources, then it's probably not going to be successful in actually promoting change. So I think that the jury is out there. I think it could be a tremendous opportunity, or it could be falling at an economic time that is really not going to promote change.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Lisanne DeStefano, is director of the Illinois Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics Education Initiative. She's also the Fox Family Professor of Education and Professor of Education Psychology here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about school reform, talking a little bit about that law known as No Child Left Behind, what the intent was, how it worked, and then also about some of the ideas that the Obama administration has proposed to try to improve education, including a reworking of this thing called that we call No Child Left Behind. Questions welcome. We have several. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. And the next caller is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call, and I wanted to say that I'm really anxious and looking forward to talking to you briefly. I'm actually going to be a newly certified teacher coming up in May. It's a retraining, so I'm almost 40 and going into teaching.
Congratulations.
I think so. I enjoy teaching. It just seems like everything else that surrounds it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few things that I'd like to ask you about, kind of 1, 2, 3, 4.
Sure.
The first one was a while ago I did some looking into and studying of the original No Child Left Behind background, where mm-hmm. it came from in Dallas. And I was looking for some confirmation on this first part, is that the person that originally designed the No Child Left Behind, Left Behind background had put together this framework from a school system, and they used testing systems to bring about improvements in their students. And the thing was that I found is that the students hadn't been tested across the board, for example, leaving out some of the very same students that have the problems that are in the current No Child Left Behind, such as students with disabilities. The second one is I'm really, really worried about testing is because I don't feel like it fosters creative output. It teaches you the test, and the teachers I know get really hung up on making sure you put out the right answer. Having seen some of the testing packets, I've seen how there's a lot of distractors that are involved, and I can see how it'd be very difficult for students to navigate the test, much less succeed. I mean, some kids taking them have such hurdles as being able to read at all. And I've always wondered about something I've kind of called myself regimental testing. I don't understand how testing a third grade this year is applicable to testing that a third grade the next year and the next year, because each cadre is going to have its own, foibles.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last part is kind of the punitive side. I'm really curious about is I don't understand why you would yank funds away from a school that is struggling. I do understand holding people to standards and accountability, but I'm just bewildered why you would not you, I mean why somebody would take away from a school that obviously needs help and not an extra pounding. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to just, once again, thank you very much for coming on the show. I'm looking forward to entering the teaching profession and being part of whatever solution I can, and I'm really looking forward to your insights.
Great, great. Well, I'll try to remember all those parts, and I saw David writing things down.
Well, we'll do our best. That'll give us enough to talk about for the next couple of hours, Madeline.
First of all, in regard to how inclusive was the No Child Left Behind and the state models on which it's based, you are right that in the early years of large-scale assessment accountability, some subgroups of students, students with disabilities, English language learners, were not included in the accountability system, largely because the types of measures that we were using, paper and pencil tests, were not very good ways to engage those children, not very good representations of their performance. I think this is an area where we've actually made some gains in the United States in figuring out ways of incorporating all students into the accountability systems and coming up with assessment measures that more accurately reflect the performance of different subgroups. And I think that will continue under the reauthorization. I think there's sensitivity to that. But you've really touched on a key area that, you know, these assessment-based accountability systems are only as good as the measures that are used. And our assessment technology has not really kept pace with the kind of demands that No Child Left Behind and this reauthorization put on them. And so the investment in coming up with new information technology, including longitudinal data systems, your point of comparing this year's third graders with next year's third graders doesn't make sense, is absolutely right. It presumes that those groups of third graders are the same. So what really a key part of Race to the Top and a key part of the reauthorization are states developing longitudinal data systems that actually collect lots of different types of students' information throughout their careers and to use that information as a basis for making judgments about student performance. And here's where our advances in technology are really coming to bear on this. In fact, when I leave this interview, I'm going to be walking over to the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and there's a Race to the Top meeting there to talk about how can we use cloud computing and high computing environments to produce these data systems that are going to be able to keep all this information about students and make it usable to parents and teachers to make judgments about student performance. So I think that we're going to see big changes in how we assess students and the types of information that are going to be used in these accountability systems. And the goal is by 2015 to have these new learning performance management systems and longitudinal data systems in place in all of the states. So that's an area that's really going to be developed here. On the third point about the incentives and the punishment, again, I think that this reauthorization has learned from No Child Left Behind that, that just sanctions do not create the kind of environment where people kind of step up to the plate and put forth the effort that's necessary to produce the kinds of changes that we're wanting to see. So there's a lot of talk about incentives, incentives in terms of teacher pay and principal pay, incentives in terms of rewards to schools who produce significant changes in achievement. And so I think that the intent, anyway, is to look more on incentivizing change and what's a good federal role for incentivizing rather than sanctioning, because I think it's been fairly clear that the sanctioning role has not really produced the kinds of changes that that we're expecting. Right.
I have some other callers, and I wanted to try to get to them. I appreciate the questions that the last caller posed. They're all really good, and they could keep us talking for a long time. Maybe we can try and and get back a little bit to some of those other things, but I also want to get into some of the other people who are listening here and who are holding on. So to do that, again, we'll go next to someone in Indiana on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi. I just want to, you know, thank the lady because the question I was going to ask with the last two callers has been answered pretty completely. I was going to ask what data was used and assumptions for even getting that program started in the Bush administration. I was immediately, I'm an ex-teacher of some sort, and I was immediately incredulous when Bush put the stamp on it that I just couldn't believe that a man who's never really had to struggle with any damn thing, except maybe eating, would even understand what young kids go through in situations in the school environment. And I experience things that it just amazed me in some school. So keep up the good work.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, using that cloud stuff sounds very interesting. It'd be nice to get NASA and all the big boys in on this. You know, put some money where it needs to be put, that's
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And those sanctions, I used to see kids just, you know, cry
mm-hmm.
because they only had one chance. One chance.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't make it. They may have had a bad day, got their butts beat before or whatever, but that was it.
Mm-hmm.
One chance.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard to tell them what was going on. You know, I didn't believe it myself, so it made it very difficult. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Well, that maybe gets back to mm-hmm. one of the other points I think that the previous call, the one before this one mentioned, and that is, you know, people make this criticism that this reliance on high stakes testing,
mm-hmm.
a test that you're only going to give it a couple of points, and the testing that's limited in terms of its subject matter. You know, if you say you're going to test kids twice on math and reading, that really does not give you a very rounded,
correct.
Complex, nuanced picture of the student
mm-hmm.
and his or her ability. And then as this caller suggests, you know, that's an awful lot riding on one test one day.
Mm-hmm.
Is some of the things that they're not talking about
mm-hmm.
in Washington, does that try to get at some of that?
Exactly. The language that you hear in the reauthorization are formative assessment, which is assessment that's done during the course of instruction and is used to make changes in the instruction, and also something that they call through-course assessment. So rather than waiting to the end of the year to a single course or a single test to decide did this student make it or not, to actually be collecting assessment data throughout a course to be able to say, okay, here's what a student knows and is able to do, rather than having the passing of a single test be the criterion. Another point that this last caller made me think about is, you know, I think the idea of setting the standard as in 2020, all students will graduate and be on track to graduate college or career ready, also takes the discussion a little bit out of the K-12 arena and acknowledges that there's linkages between K-12 education and business. There's linkages between K-12 education and secondary education. One of the things that I've seen Race to the Top do is bring those different sectors together, business and industry, higher education, and K-12 together to talk about educational issues. And I think this could be legacy of this reauthorization, not just labeling this as a problem of K-12 education, but realizing that these different sectors need to collaborate in order to produce good outcomes.
Yeah. About 10 minutes left here. Our guest is Lizanne DiStefano. She's professor of educational psychology at University of Illinois here, Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about public schools, school reform, No Child Left Behind, where that's headed. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Up next, a caller in Naperville, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good afternoon or good morning. I think there's too much emphasis put on testing. I don't know. I had problems when I was growing up as testing because I got too nervous. My son had that too. And I know a lot of kids where I'm at are having the same problem. So does that constitute a failing grade?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I think there's another big extreme of putting too much emphasis on money, money, money. Every time it's every year we need to put more money, more money. And I read on all these situations where some of the schools, like in the bigger metropolitan cities like Chicago and Detroit and L.A., the way the monies are split up in the state is unfair because they're failing. And, you know, somebody like in Naperville or Geneva or whatever are doing great. Why is that? It's the same quality teachers, same curriculum. You know, and it's like, you know, tax. The other thing is the tax base. You're forcing people to put the property taxes are going insane for the amount of educated kids we're putting out. I don't see it. I think it's kind of that whole system needs to be revamped. I think the teachers are the ones that are really getting the brunt of this. I mean, we've got some great teachers out there, but they're not getting their just reward. They're not getting what, you know, ask them what they think to teach kids out there nowadays. It's just stuff that I've seen. It's insane. Even with my local school board, it's gotten way and above over what it should be. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, the federal legislation does not have a lot to say about funding for schools. That's still largely a state and local issue, and again varies a lot across states and localities. The one thing that they do talk about funding in the proposed reauthorization is the idea that within a district, funding has to be distributed equitably across all schools and all students in the district. So within a district, there can't be some schools where the average per pupil expenditure is $14,000 and another in the same district where it's $7,000. The districts have to show that they have equitable funding. But from a federal perspective, there isn't that much to be said about the issue of local funding of schools.
I think the caller expresses this frustration. I think a lot of people do, parents, students, mm-hmm. teachers, about testing.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, though, you have to ask, well, if you want to do an assessment of large numbers of students
mm-hmm.
In an effective and efficient way, and you want it to be standardized in the sense that you can try to make some comparisons mm-hmm. between one class and another, between one school and another, and one district and another, and what, you know, you go mm-hmm. on and on. Is there really any other way to do it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that that any kind of judgment that you have to make about student performance is going to be based on some sort of assessment. I think the model that we use is sort of single event at the end of the year, at the state level test, is probably the most fragile model of all. And as the caller said, is the most prone to be affected by test anxiety, you know, little idiosyncratic things that don't produce a really good view of student performance. And so in new views of assessment, they're actually thinking about collecting data throughout a school year that talks about student performance and really reducing the importance of any kind of end of the year or end of course assessment to just one other data point that you'd use with a lot of other information to make a judgment about student performance. This kind of a system obviously is more complicated than a single test score. And so we need high-tech information technology, and we need trained teachers to be able to make sense out of more complicated information. But that's definitely the direction that the reauthorization is pushing schools and states to look toward.
Next is Champaign Line 1. Hello.
Hello. If you've already addressed this, my apologies. I'm wondering if you have read Diane Ravitch's The Death and Life of the Great American School System.
Mm-hmm. I have.
And the subtitle is How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education.
Mm-hmm.
One of the many points that she makes is that the reports from the states have consistently been higher than they should be,
mm-hmm.
That they tend to produce results that are way above what national tests show.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication is that this is a form of cooking the books.
Mm-hmm.
And she also goes on to make several other criticisms, but I'm just curious to know what you make of her critique in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that you say that because I was just in Denver last week at a group of academics who were asked to come together and sort of give advice about Race to the Top and the reauthorization. And I think most of the education scholars in that room had read Ms. Ravitch's book and were very struck by the fact that she had sort of done this reversal and was rethinking some of the things that she felt so strongly, some convictions that she felt so strongly about, and now saying, well, you know, maybe we went down the wrong road. I think the other thing that they said is nothing, all of those things in the book, all the revelations that she had, were things that many educational researchers had told the administration, the Bush administration, about at the beginning. Here's the dangers. Here's the things that could happen. And so the fact that she's sort of recounting this, you know, 8 years later, they said, well, you know, if you would have listened to us in the beginning, you could have avoided all this. But I think that there was a general feeling that the things that were reported in there are the artifacts of this high stakes accountability test driven system. And so it's a very valuable book and hopefully one that will have input impact in this reauthorization. I'm sure it's not an accident that it's coming out now.
All right. Again, another caller here, Thomas Burrow. This would be line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I kind of like to go to the crux of the problem. One of the problems we're having in the middle school is we can use all the different teaching techniques. We can give all the tutoring we want. But we still have the problem. The children have not memorized, dealing with math, have not memorized their multiplication tables. And trying to get them to do their homework is like pulling teeth. The students that we do have excel, the parents are totally involved in ensuring that everything's done. And the students that continue to fail, the parents are involved in trying to get those children to do the homework is very difficult. So it seems like we have to come down to it. It doesn't cost any money to do a math problem and learn how to do math in the math part. You simply take the pencil to the paper and do it with assistance after different teaching techniques and lots of tutoring as necessary. But what we keep seeing over and over again, and it's not a school failing or a system failing, it's individual student, because these students, and too many of them, just simply don't take the time, don't do the effort on how to get it and how to do the, simply do the problems over and over again. And, I mean, I know this is an enduring problem that Lausanne has discussed for probably, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, here's the crux. We can spend all the money on assessment. We can put all the money we want into paying teachers. But unless the student somehow would get to the point where the student sits down with a piece of paper and a pencil with assistance and does problem after problem after problem for math, memorizes the multiplication tables, it doesn't matter. A problem I had with my sixth graders and my eighth graders is they didn't have multiplication tables. So when I started to do fractions and started introducing algebra, they're totally lost. I mean, and you can't do that. So now they go back on a calculator, and when the calculator is broken or they go to work, or they have to do it on the job at Walmart, they're out of luck. So I guess in the enduring problem, and I know Lausanne's addresses, and I know it's frustrating for her totally, but, there's where it's really at. And what can we do, and what can we hope for? How do we get the students on track?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I always encourage schools to look at is how they use time within the school and how they use information within the school. And so I think that something that is mentioned in this reauthorization, and I hope schools capitalize on, is the use of assessment information. So to identify those students who aren't learning their multiplication tables for whatever reason, is it effort, is it time, is it capacity of the student, and then to provide time within the school day and support to families who choose to be involved in their kids' education to help that student get the extra practice and the opportunities to practice and master things that they can. So, I think use of after-school programs, Saturday academies, summer sessions are all things that we have not explored consistently in this country. They're a part of many countries' regular education system, after-school programs, Saturday academies, summer sessions. We do not have them consistently in this country. So maybe to think about how to use time flexibly to be able to provide that extra practice and support that some kids and families need.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. We're coming down to the point where you just have a couple of minutes left. One thing that I want to get back to just for a moment, as you have said, and I think some of our callers have pointed out, one of the criticisms of No Child Left Behind was that was the punitive aspects. Mm-hmm. That is, the sanctions that schools would suffer, cuts in federal money if they don't meet the standards. And I think that from what I have read about what the Obama administration is thinking about is that they want to try to move away from that some,
right,
and go more to the carrots and fewer sticks. And yet at the same time, aren't they also still, though, talking about there have to be some consequences if schools don't meet the standards, and don't you end up in the same place?
Mm-hmm. I think that the basic standards of failure to acquire federal funds or loss of federal funds underlie this reauthorization, too. I think that what is proposed in this reauthorization, which wasn't apparent in No Child Left Behind, are the incentives. And they have something that they call reward schools, reward districts, reward states, so that if a state or a district or a school can demonstrate that they're showing certain levels of student gain, that they have certain levels of teacher and principal effectiveness, they will get this reward status. And what the reward status allows them to do is that they're released from certain accountability requirements. They don't have to participate in all of the different pieces of the accountability system. They're allowed to use funds more flexibly than schools who don't have the reward status. So there is an incentive piece that if for schools that are demonstrably effective or districts that are demonstrably effective, they actually are freed from some of the accountability and reporting requirements. They're also able to compete for a special group of competitive funds that aren't available to other schools. So that's the reward mechanisms that they're trying to use.
Yeah, we're down again. We're sort of up at the end here, and I hate to end on such a negative note, but what concerns me, and I'm sure concerns mm-hmm. a lot of people, is you know we're talking about the kinds of things we could do if resources were not limited. But the mm-hmm. fact of the matter is now, because so many states are facing such serious financial problems that we have really, really serious resource issues mm-hmm. at local schools. Mm-hmm. We here at the University of Illinois, we're concerned about state support of higher education. Mm-hmm. Well, local school districts are facing the same issues.
Very critical.
Like
yes.
Here in Champaign and Urbana, the schools are owed millions mm-hmm. of dollars. Mm-hmm. And around the country and looking at what schools are doing. They're laying off teachers. They're talking about going to a 4-day school week. They're closing schools. You have to wonder here over the next few years how it is that's, you know, let's not even worry about peak performance. Mm-hmm. Let's just worry about keeping the school open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're at a watershed moment in American public education right now where we have to realistically consider and rethink our funding mechanism, our support of schools, and maybe most importantly, the value of public education in America society. So the reauthorization is absolutely coming at a critical point in American education.
Yeah. How is that going to play out here over the next year? I mean, mm-hmm. is this really, you think this is really, now that health care reform is mm-hmm. sort of done, this mm-hmm. is this the thing that seems to be kind of at the top of the
agenda? I believe
so.
And you know, I guess on the I'm trying to end on a positive note instead of a negative note, David. I'm hoping that maybe this will mean that it will catalyze people, higher education, the business community, K-12 schools, to engage in the reauthorization in a meaningful and constructive way. I don't mean to be Pollyannish about it, but one of the good things about it happening at a watershed moment is that it may get people's interest and result in some profound change that may actually, remediate some of the chronic problems that we've seen in American yeah. public education.
Our guest, Lizanne DiStefano, is Fox Family Professor of Education, also Professor of Educational Psychology at University of Illinois. Thank you.
Thank you very much.